I was desperately looking for audio from last year's Republican retort to the State of the Union. Couldn't find it, but I will keep looking. In the meantime, let's get David Swanson on the line. David Swanson, co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.org. He blogs at davidswanson.org. He is also...
Hi, it's David.
Hey, David. Nicole Sandler here at RadioOrNot.com.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing tonight?
I'm great. I'm great.
Well, we are live online. Got lots of people watching the feed on Ustream and up on the website at RadioOrNot.com. And I thank you for joining us tonight in our inaugural week after the transition from Air America Radio to the online world.
Yes. Well, welcome to the online world. It's the only place that will have me, too. I hope that when we get a new Air America, that you're on it every day.
Well, thank you. I was also just reminded by somebody, by Dr. Bill of PDA California, that you're on the National PDA Advisory Board, Progressive Democrats of America. And you seem to be everywhere. You're out still doing the tour for the book Threshold. Undoing the imperial presidency and forming a more perfect union. So I guess let's start with that. We've got our president who we had, well, I know you warned a bit against about Obama before the election, that he was not all that many putting so much hope into him thought he was. But boy, he's turning out to be a lot less than even that, isn't he?
Yeah, I don't know if thought is even a word that is deserved here. I think fantasized is more like it. Millions and millions of people thought that this president would be the first guy ever to keep all of his promises without even having to push him to do so, plus all kinds of promises that he never made, that he was secretly keeping to himself to be better than what he was advertising himself as, which is just craziness. But, here we are with another State of the Union that's, a big like the Super Bowl, and it's just talk. We're waiting a year for some kind of actions that we want to see happen, and we're going to have a bunch of talk, and not a lot of people are going to care. Polling on presidents doesn't change because of their speeches in States of the Union, but this president is not going to talk about any of the things that I want to know about. I mean, how many times has there been a State of the Union right after a newspaper reported that the president has a list of Americans for assassination?
Wait a minute. Back up, because I didn't hear that. The president has a list of Americans for assassination?
This came up in a Washington Post article today, I think. Could have been late yesterday. Has been blogged about by Marcy Wheeler and Glenn Greenwald and various other good bloggers in reference to, in discussing one particular individual, there's reference made to the list of Americans to be killed. This kind of thing won't be talked about. The fact that we've thrown out all kinds of laws and are not prosecuting the gang that we voted out that committed so many obvious crimes, that torture is ongoing because we won't prosecute torture, that the illegal aggressive wars are ongoing and expanded. I don't think this president is going to talk about the wars much at all tonight, and maybe he won't do too much fear-mongering, which would be a good change, but he's mostly going to talk about the economy and employment, while in terms of actions, the bulk of the money, and ever increasingly, is going into wars and the military, which is the place that produces the fewest number of jobs, does the least good to the economy, in addition to all the other damage it does. So the talk is not going to fit the actions any more than the speech in the Middle East, the language fit the actions.
Well, and you got that right. And then we saw Scott Brown defeat a Democrat for a Senate seat in Massachusetts, one of the bluest states in the nation. That should have been a real wake up call to this administration that they're leaving their base behind. They're not doing what they were elected to do. And then 2 days later, he comes out and announces a domestic spending freeze in the time of a severe recession?
Yeah, and you know, Jared Bernstein, who is the vice president's top guy on this middle class economic stuff.
That's who was on with Rachel the other night. She took him apart.
He used to be a friend of progressive activists. He used to help us out when I worked for Acorn. He no longer says a single word he believes. He's completely sold his soul. And he went on Rachel Maddow's show and probably elsewhere to defend this outrageously indefensible policy of saying that, you know, we will put an overall freeze on spending in anything other than the areas of killing people. That is, we've got a record military budget, record war budget, record number of troops and mercenaries in the field, record number of bases and countries occupied around the world, and we're going to keep upping that. We're going to have another record military budget. We're going to have another war supplemental spending bill of the kind we were never going to have again. But we'll put a freeze on spending it on anything else. You know, this is disastrous. This is moving in absolutely the wrong direction on the biggest question that hurts everything else. And so, you know, he'll say some good things, I'm sure. He'll throw pocket change at this or that good item, maybe a few more trains, and that's nice. But I wouldn't cheer for anything under $30 billion, you know, because that's the least they ever spend on wars.
It is mind-boggling. We have John McCain, who during the election, I mean, I remember watching one of the debates, and John McCain says, "Well, we should have an across the board spending free, all domestic spending freeze." And Obama's response was something like, "Well, that's taking a hatchet when what you need is a carving knife." And so here he is doing a total 180 and going for John McCain's ideas. In terms of health care, McCain is the one who campaigned on taxing high-end health care insurance policies, and Obama was against it. Now, look, did we vote for Barack Obama or did we vote for John McCain?
Well, his advisors have this strategy that when Democrats aren't interested and independents and progressives and liberals aren't interested in what you're doing, don't try to win them over, even though they're out there by the tens of millions. Try to get a handful of Republicans to come over to your side by out-Republicaning the Republicans, which won't work, you know. And they try to spin all of these things. They try to say, well, John McCain wanted to put a freeze on each and every little item, whereas we're just saying in these general departments there's a freeze, but within we can take some money from this pocket and put it into that one. But he's still dealing with pocket change compared to where the bulk of the money is going with no limits. Why in the world should there be no limits on the most destructive, most wasteful, most corrupt place we're putting all of our money?
So what do we do, David Swanson? You are my favorite activist. How do we fight back? I mean, people came out in great numbers in November to vote for the change candidate, and what we're getting is the third term of George W. Bush. I mean, a lot of the same people in the administration. He never even got rid of the U.S. attorneys, which is one of the first things an incoming administration does.
I think we take the focus to the extent possible. I know it won't be possible for like the next 3 days or so off the president to begin with. And we put it on the House of Representatives and we go to the House of Representatives and say, here are the things we demand of you. And we treat them as elected officials who do good things and do bad things. And they're not excused for everything if they're a Democrat or condemned for everything if they're a Republican, but are related to in terms of the good and bad things they do, and they all do some of each. And we begin by insisting that they not put another dollar into these wars. They have this supplemental spending bill coming up for $33 billion on top of, yet again, the world's biggest military budget. And they have to vote no on that. And you already have the peace groups starting to say, not all of them, but some of them starting to say, well, let's improve that bill. Let's get this and that measure in there and say we'd like an exit strategy someday and so forth. You know, it's beyond time for such a waste of energy. We have to build a list of Congress members who will actually take a stand. And if it turns out, as some people have already concluded, that some of the progressives in the House have actually taken a stand on health care to at least the extent of saying we won't just roll over and support the Senate bill, that has to be applauded and encouraged tremendously, just as we have to keep beating up on these people for never, ever taking a stand on anything else that's useful.
That's right. But as we know, let's talk about health care for a moment. The Congressional Progressive Caucus, 60-some-odd members, signed a letter saying that they would vote against anything, any bill that didn't have a robust public option. And when it came down to time for the vote, the only two who held true to their words were Dennis Kucinich and Eric Massa. Now, I've had Raul Grijalva on the program a number of times. He is the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, and he was going to come on with me today, and then they begged off and said he really wants to hear what the president has to say first, but he's actually making some tough noises. Now, the question is, do you think that the CPC, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, will have the fortitude enough to stand up and do the right thing?
Well, Fire Dog Lake, which has been a good activist group blog on this, has already come to the conclusion and begun rewarding and praising Raul Grijalva, come to the conclusion that he single-handedly, apparently, has taken such a tough stand that the Senate bill won't go through the House as stands. And if so, that's to be applauded and rewarded, but it's not nearly good enough. As you mentioned, back in June, 57 and then some more of them took a stand for minimum requirements for a health care bill that the House bill didn't meet, and most of them rolled over and voted for it. Mm-hmm. And Raul Grijalva has maintained right along, and Lynn Wolsey and the rest of them, that they now love the House bill that back in June didn't meet their minimum standards on which they pretended to take a stand. So can we get them to go back at least to the standards they had in June, or something stronger? And or can we get them to insist that the language to facilitate state solutions to health care is put back in, that was stripped out, that Congressman Kucinich had passed in committee as
right.
an amendment?
Right, and actually that Senator Bernie Sanders has similar language in the Senate bill. Unfortunately, the way it was written in the Senate bill was that the state's waivers, as they're called, wouldn't go into effect until a certain number of years after the exchanges went in, and he was pushing to have them happen concurrently. But the fact of the matter is, it seems like the only way we're going to get any kind of health care legislation right now is if the House does indeed pass the Senate bill. And the only way they would do that is with some real assurances that immediately fixes would be made to it via reconciliation that would either put in a public option or the Medicare buy-in, hopefully get rid of the antitrust exemption, and bring back the Dorgan amendment that would have allowed for reimportation of prescription drugs. But the chances of that happening are slim to none, and I wouldn't trust the Senate as far as I can throw them to say, oh, sure, we'll do that for you, just pass our bill.
Well, I, in my opinion, even the House bill as passed last summer is worse than nothing. So getting nothing in the immediate future is a victory as far as I'm concerned. And if progressives play a role in that by saying we won't go down yet another notch into an even worse bill, that's very, very good news. And they have to be encouraged and rewarded and applauded heartily for that if that should happen, because they will catch hell for it from Nancy and Rahm and Barack and gang.
Yep.
In my view, the only way we're going to get real health care reform in the new future is if the states do it. And there are more and more states working on it. And major states like California just need a different governor who would sign it, have already passed the bill more than once to create a real civilized single-payer healthcare solution.
So, David Swanson, you think they should just, the Obama administration should just scrap healthcare reform, put this whole year behind them and say, we lost and move on? I mean, this is the game of politics. This is the biggest reality show out there. And you think they're just going to give up and say, all right, we'll take this one on the chin?
Well, I think they're going to take it on the chin one way or the other. If they pass this bill, which is guaranteed not to fix this ever-worsening
yep.
crisis, then once we get down the road and it's not fixed, they're going to get the blame. And the blame is going to be placed on the so-called health care reform, which is going to make it even harder then to enact the serious reform that's needed. I think if they want to pass the thing, they'll throw out the filibuster rule, as they could do any day, and pass the thing. If they want to keep that excuse in place, that's their business. We should make absolutely clear to every senator and every Congress member that we know that that's an excuse, that we don't fall for it. At the same time, in terms of their political calculations as Democrats, if they want to blame the Republicans for their own refusal to act, at least on this issue, I would say, quit now and declare defeat and blame it on the Republicans now, rather than actually passing something that we are now seeing Democrats around the country campaigning against. It's so unpopular.
I know. Well, because it's a big bloated piece of crap bill that doesn't address the problems. I mean, even for people who say, but you get rid of pre-existing conditions. Not really, because there's no cost containment there. So here, and I'm a perfect example of it. Right now, my COBRA runs out next month from when I lost the job here in Miami almost 18 months ago. I have a pre-existing condition. I just had a skin cancer removed. No one will insure you until you're skin cancer free for 10 years. So I'm screwed, right? But there is this HIPAA law that says if you have continual coverage, for 18 months and all, there's six questions. And if you can answer yes to all those six questions, they can't deny you coverage. In other words, they have to cover you. They have to write a policy even if you've had a pre-existing condition, the company you're with now. However, it comes at a premium. It is, I think, their highest cost plan plus 10% times two. So basically, it would cost me around $1,000 a month plus a $5,000 deductible plus before I ever get the insurance company ever pays a dime. And then if the Senate bill were to go through, I'd get taxed on it on top of that because it's considered a pre-existing condition. If they pass this, it's the same deal because they can charge me two, three, four times more for the policy. Yes, they have to write it, but there's no limit to what they can charge me for it. So they can price me out of the market and effectively not give me coverage because I can't afford it.
That's right. That's right. And then if you refuse to buy a lousy product that's overpriced that you can't afford and you make your rational market decision not to buy it, potentially we're going to have the government tax or fine you.
That's right.
For that.
That's right.
For your failure.
Because of the mandate.
For your money to a private corporation.
Right. Something else that this president campaigned against, mandates. So, how many lies have we caught him in? Things that, you can go out and call it a lie, or you could say, well, he flip-flopped, he changed his mind. But it seems like on all these major issues, he's, now that he's in office, he's doing the things that his opponent campaigned on and he campaigned against.
But we have virtually no leverage against a president. Maybe Floridians and Ohio and a couple other places have a little bit of sway. But, for the most part, presidents can ignore most of us.
If they actually counted the votes, yeah.
Right. That's another question, mm-hmm. which goes to Massachusetts as well. We mm-hmm. keep talking as if we know what happened there, but nobody
right.
can possibly know what
no.
happened there, despite
Diebold can.
The Democrat right. breaking the land speed record in conceding,
that's right.
outdoing
yep.
John Kerry. Nobody has any, before a single hand touched a single ballot. The thing is that we can't expect a president to fix everything. And if a president did, the next president could unfix it all. We have to go the long way through Congress. We have more control over Congress, albeit very little, and we have much more over states. And we're going to see states do real health care solutions before Washington does, no matter what Washington does. And so I think we have to facilitate that to the extent we can and put our efforts there, and then try to pressure Washington from state successes.
Okay. So David Swanson is with us. He is he blogs at davidswanson.org. He's a co-founder of democrats.com and afterdowningstreet.org. And you're going to be live blogging the State of the Union tonight along with a bunch of other bloggers. Where at?
Institute for Public Accuracy, ipaccuracy.wordpress.com. They've got a bunch of great people lined up over there, Kathy Kelly and Margaret Flowers and Doug Henwood, and a bunch of people already starting to blog in on what they anticipate is going to be said. And,
okay.
You know, excerpts have been released and read. And it looks like the president is trying very hard to avoid anything that could come back and bite him. And maybe that's just the initial excerpts they put out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty, you know, in terms of this Supreme Court decision, his solution is pass a bill. That's the extent of it. Pass a bill, some sort of bill. You know, his big claim to success for the past year in what they've released thus far is that for the first time in history, we put White House visitors online.
Oh, God.
You know, now, for what percentage of history has there been an online,
yep,
on which to,
right,
put White House visitors?
Right. And
for
a president
all those ones that he won't put,
exactly,
online?
Exactly. And for a president who promised transparency,
yeah,
come on, you're bragging about this?
That was a footnote in the promises. That's the highlight in the successes and the claims to having made the government transparent. And it's outrageous, following a paragraph in which he talks about health care, to make that claim when he won't tell us the names of the health executives.
Uh-huh, exactly. And that stuff was supposed to be broadcast on C-SPAN.
Yeah, the meetings were supposed to be on C-SPAN. Not just we get the names, but we,
right,
see the meetings.
Exactly.
So it's a little bit of a come down, you know. Now, if he says repeal, don't ask, don't tell, I think that's a good thing. You know, there may be some good things. But, you know, that's going to be the best of it, is the president telling Congress what good things to do, which is not really the role I want to see a president in anyway.
Yeah, I know. I gotcha. Now, David Swanson, you were back here in Miami on the book tour for Threshold. I think it was it in May? Was it? No, it wasn't that long ago. September, I think, or October. Anyway, back
Threshold,
then.
Threshold, I think that's Tom Hartman's or somebody.
I'm sorry,
else.
Not Threshold. Daybreak.
Daybreak.
Sorry about that. Undoing the Imperial,
okay,
Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. Daybreak is the David Swanson book. But so you were down in Miami for the book tour, and we were talking about the upcoming Supreme Court decision, Citizens United versus the FEC, the Federal Elections Commission, and what we feared was going to happen did happen. And this is really bad. I mean, I've been talking about it a lot both before and since the decision on Thursday. But where do we stand now? Where does this leave us?
Well, the good news, and there always is good with bad, the good news is I've seen a lot more activism. I've heard from a lot more people that they want to be engaged and fight back, and they're outraged and they want to take action in the past week than in the previous 2 years. I mean, the outrage that we thought would be tapped at this point is materializing. Now, where do we go with that? There are all kinds of actions being pursued, and again, there's going to be a lot of important work done at the state level. There are state bills being introduced in numerous states to go after corporations, to not let state contractors give money to state elections, to not let, you know, to insist that two-thirds of shareholders pre-approve and so forth. But it's all very limited stuff. And in Congress, you know, Congressman Grayson from Florida has perhaps the best set of bills to, you know, to use antitrust, to tax this spending at 500%, to require majority approval by shareholders beforehand, and so on and so forth. But it's all very limited. And ultimately, we're going to have to amend the Constitution. And there are a number of great campaigns that have been launched One that I'm working for is at freespeechforpeople.org.
Mm-hmm.
And today, Congresswoman Donna Edwards introduced the constitutional amendment that we're lobbying for, which essentially says that you cannot construe the First Amendment to restrict the powers of Congress or the states in limiting what corporations do with their money. Corporations are creations of states. They're not human beings. I think that's the way we're going to have to go. There's another great campaign at movetoamend.org, which essentially wants an amendment that they don't have yet that says corporations are not persons.
Right.
But, you know, it gets problematic because we don't want corporations to have no rights. We just want them to have the rights that states give them, not assume all of the rights that persons, human beings, are supposed to have in our Constitution, which are not necessarily the same thing.
No, not at all. And this decision, I mean, it's so funny. When the Republicans don't like a judicial decision, they go on and on about the activist judges. But what we saw from the Supreme Court is these five very activist judges throwing out well over 100 years of law.
Indeed, and without having been asked to do so by any parties in the case, having gone out of their way to take up the case and then having gone off on a tangent and construed it to raise issues that it didn't raise, and then came to conclusions that didn't even impact the outcome of the particular case, and in the process overturning previous Supreme Court decisions and threatening laws in at least a couple dozen states that are now at risk because they restrict corporate spending on electioneering. So this is an incredible change, which, you know, that in itself doesn't mean it's for the worse, but I think in this case it clearly is for the worse. And even people like Glenn Greenwald and Jonathan Turley and the AFL-CIO, you know, even and the ACLU, people who defend this admit that it will do great damage to the country. I mean, these free speech fundamentalists who say, well, you can't restrict free speech, say that they're adhering to the original First Amendment, even though they admit that this will do incredible damage to the country. I think they're wrong to go into this ivory tower and assume that the outcome of a decision is not what we ought to base our thinking on. But I also think they're wrong on the idea that the First Amendment simply must apply to corporations as well. I think the people who wrote it would be outraged. I think jurists from all through American history would be outraged. I think it's a shocking twist. And you know, nobody's trying to say that all spending of money on electioneering must be blocked, that money never has any relationship to speech. And nobody's trying to say corporations should have no rights. All we want to say is that corporations don't automatically get personal rights under the First Amendment, which is made for people.
Well, and that's what it goes back to. Corporations are not persons. A corporation can't die or be buried. A corporation, if it breaks the law, can't go to jail. So did you hear about this Murray Hill Incorporated running for Congress?
Yes, there are all kinds of, you know, there are Facebook groups, Walmart for Congress, and so on, and people trying to figure out if you can marry a corporation, and mm-hmm. are corporations going to get to vote, and so forth. You know, I also love the idea of personal corporatehood. That is, can we get the rights that corporations have?
Right.
You know, to see how our votes are counted and not have to buy health insurance and to get immunity for your crimes and so forth. I mean, corporations' rights are outweighing the rights of actual flesh and blood human beings all the time.
Yeah, well, welcome to the United Corporations of America.
This is where we're going. And people say, you know, I wrote a long blog today basically responding to and debating with a blog by Glenn Greenwald defending this decision. And he argues that, you know, even though he doesn't think outcomes should be considered whatsoever, he doesn't see any bad outcome because things couldn't get worse. You know, it's true that things are pretty bad, but to imagine that things couldn't get worse, I mean, corporations don't want Social Security. If you give corporations a little more power, Social Security is going to be gone. I mean, you don't need a dramatic imagination to see how things are going to be worse.
No, not at all. I'm actually surprised that Glenn Greenwald is defending this, and Jonathan Turley, too. I did not hear that.
Well, I mentioned them because I usually agree with them on a lot
of
things.
Yeah, so do I.
But, you know, they come out of the same legalistic background as a lot of people in the ACLU, which, you know, takes this position. You know, we will defend free speech for the Ku Klux Klan. We will defend free speech for corporations. We'll defend free speech for vegetables if they say vegetables have it. You know, you can't limit free speech in any way whatsoever, no matter how absurd the expansion of free speech, even though what you're doing is eliminating any voice in our political system for most of us. Because speech, at least when we start out, everybody's got roughly the same power of speech, but money, a few people have most of it. Mm-hmm. And so there's a fundamental difference that they're refusing to recognize.
It's frightening. It's scary. And I think it can get a whole lot worse. David Swanson, I know you got to get ready for the speech. I thank you so much for spending time with us tonight. And we'll talk again soon and see where we go from here. The book is called Daybreak: Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. And read the blog at davidswanson.org. And thanks so much.
Thanks, Nicole.
Okay, take care. All right. You know, one of the issues that we're talking about is the filibuster. And one of the reasons, I mean, aside from his lack of testicular fortitude, one of the reasons that the president is having trouble getting legislation through is the filibuster. Even if there were things that he wanted to do, even if he wanted to do the right thing and pass a really good health care bill, for instance, give us a public option, or even better, single payer, you still got the obstructionist party in the Senate who is using the filibuster rule for everything. In just a moment, we're going to hear from, what is his name? Gregory Koger. He's a political scientist. He teaches American politics at the University of Miami, and he's got a book coming out about the filibuster. Before we go there, just a quick reminder. Yes, we are on late tonight. I usually sign off at 8 p.m. Eastern, but we're sticking around. I will stream at least the audio of the State of the Union address. Yeah, if you're watching the Ustream stream, you'll get to see my probably incredulous faces, and I can, you know, make faces at the camera while Obama is speaking. And we're going to be live blogging together on the new forum section at radioornot.com. So if you go there now, and if you're bookmarked on the old website, you have to go into the new website, radioornot.com, and go into, well, you'll see, once you go into the forum, you register, log in, and you'll see, well, there's two things that say SOTU for State of the Union. So go in the one that has two posts on it, and that's where we will all be posting. So we'll have a nice record of our time together. Now, the three best posts of the night that we will choose somehow, I will give a prize. I can't tell exactly what the prizes are, maybe books, but I promise you, the three best posts of the night dealing with the president's speech will get a prize. So again, go to radioornot.com, radioornot.com, and turn the sound off on the TV, listen through the stream, and that way, you know, you can have the TV up, the TV on, so you can see the picture, but listen through this, and or watch it on TV, however you want to do it, but be logged on to radioornot.com, log on to the forum, and post your comments there, and And I'll give away a few books tonight, okay? All right. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to take, well, sort of a break here. I did an interview this afternoon, as I said, with Gregory Coger, and talking about the filibuster, because, you know, we've had this discussion in here and on the Old Air America show, too, for a long time, trying to figure out what the rules are, how to get rid of the filibuster, how to get around the filibuster. So with that in mind, where did I post the interview? Here it is. All right. Here we go, and I'll be back. Joining us now is political scientist Gregory Coger. He teaches American politics at the University of Miami. So, Greg, you're right in my backyard. And you've got a new book coming out about a topic that we've been discussing a lot on the show lately. It's called Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate. And that'll be out this summer?
That's right. It's coming out in June.
Okay. Well, it would be nice if they could move it up a little bit, because the filibuster is such a hot topic right now, most notably because, well, supposedly the Democrats, after Al Franken was sworn in as senator, so it was the middle of the year, the Democrats had a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, supposedly, although it hasn't worked out so well for them. And now, just last week, they lost that 60th vote when Scott Brown beat Martha Coakley to fill Ted Kennedy's old seat in the Senate. So can we start with a little bit of history and talk about how the filibuster came about? Because it's nowhere in the Constitution, is it?
That's right. Nothing in the Constitution explicitly says that legislators have the right to filibuster.
Okay.
So how did it come about? Basically, anytime you have a legislative setting, whether that's a board meeting or a faculty meeting or a legislature, you know, they have rules of proceedings so that everybody gets a chance to speak and everybody gets a chance to make motions. And filibustering is what happens when somebody takes those sort of ordinary rights and then uses them in extraordinary ways. So, you know, take a set of rules that says that everybody has a chance to speak. Well, if you use that chance to speak to give a 24-hour speech, then you are filibustering, mm-hmm. I mean, especially if your intent is to keep the rest of the group from making a decision. So at no point did anybody say, you know, we should have filibustering. It's that people use their existing rights in extraordinary ways, and the rest of the group didn't do anything to stop it.
But you're talking about the old definition of filibuster, and what we see now in the Senate is an entirely different thing, where it's basically just the threat of a filibuster is able to stop anything from happening in the U.S. Senate.
That's right. I mean, we no longer observe active or live filibusters, I use both terms, in the Senate. That practice died out in the early 1960s when senators finally admitted that they were unlikely, that the majority was unlikely to win that sort of battle, sort of like sitting and waiting for the minority to get exhausted. And that in trying to fight that battle, they ended up wasting a lot of time and looking stupid in the process.
Right, but doesn't it, I mean, in a case like what we're seeing now, where the minority party is holding up every single piece of legislation, I would think it would be to the majority's advantage to show the American people, look, we can't get a simple bill passed because every time we attempt to do so, they filibuster it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the trick at this point for the Democrats would be to propose legislation that the Republicans have a tough time voting against, so that either they go along with the Democrats and the Democrats succeed at passing their bill, or they cast some sort of vote which the Democrats can use against them in the next election. Yes, if the Republicans vote together, they can block what the Democrats do, but then they could pay a heavy political price for that, depending on what the Democrats propose to them.
Right. So perhaps maybe if the Democrats split up this huge health care bill into a number of smaller pieces of legislation, for instance, making it impossible for insurance companies to deny somebody coverage due to a pre-existing condition and to place limits on what they could charge, have that as a standalone bill. And if the Republicans decided to filibuster that, then obviously that they would wind up paying the price for that.
That's exactly it. Like, I never understood why, well, politically speaking, I never understood why the Democrats wanted to pass one big, huge health care bill, because the sheer size of the bill then becomes a liability.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, if they break it up into pieces, and each piece, then, like, it's easier to explain, and then and it's harder to vote against. I think that would have been perhaps a much more marketable strategy.
Yeah, and the American people could understand it better.
That's right. I mean, so these limitations on you know, the worst practices of insurance companies, people understand that. And if that was proposed as a separate piece of legislation and the Republicans voted against it, then there could be a heavy political, there could have been a heavy political price for that vote.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. We're speaking with Gregory Koger, a political scientist. He teaches American politics at the University of Miami, and he's got a book coming out this June, Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate. So is there, what are the rules? We've been trying to figure out how the Senate could change the filibuster rules, and it seems like every place I look, I get a different explanation, a different rule.
Right. Well, I have two answers to the question. One is the naive answer, and then one is the sophisticated answer. And because there's two answers, maybe that explains some of the confusion out there.
Okay.
So let's do naive first. If I was a senator and I proposed a change to the Senate rules, I would introduce a resolution. And some Democrats have begun to do this in the last couple of days, or they're going to soon. So I introduce a resolution saying, you know, I want to change this provision of the Senate rules. Now, if my resolution comes up to a final passage vote, it takes a simple majority to pass the rule change.
Yeah, really?
Really, but this is a naive answer, right? So what if somebody then filibusters my proposed rule change?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in order to invoke cloture on a rules change, the threshold is especially high. So normally it takes 60 votes in the Senate, but for rules change, it takes a two-thirds vote, which is, you know, 66 or 67, depending on how many people show up.
Uh-huh.
So it's especially difficult to invoke cloture on a rules change.
Okay.
So that is the two naive answers. One is it takes a majority. The second answer is it takes a two-thirds supermajority if somebody tries to filibuster.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the rules say.
Okay.
Now, what if you're actually serious about it? And you've got a bare majority of senators who are willing to do anything to get rid of filibustering. They have some options. The underlying idea is that the Senate rules mean what a majority of the Senate say that they mean. They have the power to interpret their own rules. And that includes the ability to say that the Constitution trumps what the letter of the rules say. Or to fill in gaps in what the existing rules say. And all of this can be done by a simple majority. So the unifying idea is that a senator would do something on the floor of the Senate, which the chair of the Senate, the presiding officer says, oh no, you can't do that. And then that bare majority would overrule what the chair has just said and says, and in a sense saying, really? Because I have 50 friends who say that I can do it. And now it's done, and I win. And there's no more filibustering, or at least in a particular way, I've restricted filibustering. So just a couple examples.
Okay.
One, my favorite, in the sense that it is, I think, the most logical way to do it, one is to move a suspension of the Senate rules, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's saying that we have these rules, but I want to ignore them on this one thing. And what you can do with the suspension of the rules motion is pick a date to vote on health care reform, for example, and say, I move that we suspend the rules and agree that we're going to vote on this date.
Uh-huh.
Having made that motion, then the next thing you'd want to do when some Republican gets up to talk about it is say, actually, no, there's no debate on this motion because if you can debate it for a minute, you can debate it for a year.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no debate on these motions. And that would be a parliamentary question which could be decided by a bare majority. Then, once you get a vote on the motion to suspend the rules and set a date to vote on health care, you have your vote. Now, the letter of the rules, the Senate rule, doesn't say anything about how many votes are required to suspend the rules. In 1915, ironically, a simple majority of the Senate decided that it takes a two-thirds majority to suspend the rules of the Senate. But that's just an interpretation. And actually, it's an illogical interpretation based on the Senate, the letter of the Senate rules.
Mm-hmm.
So you need a second parliamentary precedent saying that it, sort of restoring the old meaning of the Senate rule, that it takes a simple majority to suspend the rules. Now, if you get those two precedents, then the majority sort of would completely regain control of the Senate. They could like bring up whatever bill they want and decide when they're going to have a final passage vote on that bill. It's clean in the sense that you're just restoring the true meaning of the Senate rule. All right, so that's one tactic.
Right, now, but let me interrupt for 1 second and ask a question. I mean, what I've noticed is anytime anybody wants to do anything in the Senate, don't they call for unanimous consent. Don't they need unanimous consent to, you know, go to the bathroom?
Just about, yeah.
Yeah. So without unanimous consent, how could they do any of this stuff?
Well, that's a tricky thing. I mean, what I'm suggesting would be a dramatic... I mean, I'm not even suggesting that they're advocating that should do it. But
right.
If you were to do this, then what you'd be doing is transforming the entire character of the Senate and saying, we're going to become like the House in that the majority in numbers, which usually means majority party, is taking control of this chamber, and we're going to dictate what comes up and you know, how we're going to vote on it and then when we're going to vote on it.
Right, but isn't that how, you know, it's written in the Constitution? Or isn't that the way it was supposed to be? Senate, you know, 50 plus one majority rules?
Not necessarily. I mean, what the Constitution says is that each chamber is responsible for writing its own code of rules.
Mm.
And other than that, it's pretty agnostic about how each chamber then should proceed.
Okay.
So it would be fair to say that the filibuster as we know it is a very modern development. Again, I trace it back to the 1960s. Before then, it's true that we did observe filibusters in the Senate, but they were relatively rare. And
it was the Jimmy Stewart thing. It was Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where they'd bring in the cots and you'd be prepared. It was a very rare occurrence. And when it happened, it was a big deal, right?
Yeah, right. It was a big deal. It was hard to do. And so you'd only see it usually when people were serious about whatever they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be just sort of casual, like, I want to block this nomination because I feel like it, because I have some other unrelated you know, beef with the administration. If a senator had to go to the floor and actually conduct a filibuster, it would be when they had some very serious cause to fight for.
Right.
Usually. So that's what's changed.
So here we are today when basically there's gridlock in the Senate. Nothing is getting done because the Republicans are blocking. There's not one piece of legislation that just will get passed with a simple majority. Now, to get anything passed, you need 60 votes for cloture. Do you agree with me that that's a problem?
Well, in my writing, I actually defend the filibuster as it is.
Right.
So I first make the point that a majority could get rid of the filibuster, and then the question becomes, well, why don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons for keeping filibustering around is that it forces the two parties to bargain and negotiate and come up with something they can agree with. So when the Democrats got their 60th vote, I believed, and a lot of editorials said that, you know, actually this is that's overhyped, and that we presume the Democrats are all going to vote together, and it'll be easy for them to do that. And the first part, they did actually vote together, but it was not easy to get a bill that all 60 of them could agree on.
Right. Well, you know the old saying that, you know, getting Democrats to vote together is like herding cats. If it was the Republicans with 60 votes, they'd push everything through because they seem to work in lockstep.
I think it is true that the Republicans have an easier time voting together.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you switch back to a 59-41 Senate, I think then you move back to a world in which the Democrats know that they need to negotiate from the beginning with, you know, at least one Republican. And Republicans know that they can't just sort of stand on the sidelines and point and laugh as the Democrats try to come up with unanimity among their own members, that on some level, they are, if a bill gets killed, that they are taking responsibility for it.
Right, and, but then don't we have a situation like, you know, where somebody like Olympia Snowe or now even Scott Brown has this inordinate amount of power? It's like, so who elected Scott just because he won a Senate seat from Massachusetts? All of a sudden, he's like king of the world?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, so Republicans know that if they block a bill, they bear responsibility. I don't think that bothers Mitch McConnell.
No.
So to the extent that anybody is bothered, it is going to be these Republicans at the very middle, you know, Snowe, Collins of Maine, Brown of Massachusetts. And if they're being honest, they can't say honestly that take health care reform, that if the Republicans regain the majority, they'll write a better health care reform bill. It's just, it didn't happen over the last, 15 years, and mm-hmm. it's not going to happen if the Republicans get back in the majority. So this is the best chance that they will see to reform a system that everybody knows is broken. And so now that it's 59-41, they're once more in a position to say, do I actually want this whole effort to die or not?
Mm-hmm.
And I bear responsibility if it does die.
Right. Well, I guess we'll find out tonight when the president speaks. He gives the State of the Union tonight. Do you think that as someone who teaches American politics at the University of Miami as a political scientist, that maybe he will make a case for breaking up this behemoth health care bill and putting forth smaller pieces of legislation? I mean, as a diehard liberal, I'm kind of sick of hearing him talk about bipartisan support because it's like he's rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. He's going for something that he'll never get.
Well, I don't know what he's going to say. If you could build a time machine and go back, I think that'd be the right way to try to pass health care, you know, one piece at a time, each piece then making sense relative to the other pieces. But now, I mean, I think the Democrats would be unwise to drag this out and let's start from scratch and we'll pass piece by piece. Because I don't see that happening, and I don't see that being in the best interest of the Democratic Party. So what would President Obama make a case for? Probably for finishing as soon as possible. I think that would be the wise thing.
Right, but they're not going to be able to get it through as it is. So now let's move on to another topic that's been discussed a lot, reconciliation. Can you explain exactly what budget, because reconciliation, we heard that when they were going to reconcile the bills between the House and the Senate. Now, that's not happening. Budget reconciliation is a way to get things through the Senate with just 51 votes, right?
That's right. Budget reconciliation, that's it's a process put into law starting with the 1974 Budget Act. And you're right. So what it means is that a piece of legislation that is reconciling Congress's budget plan with the existing law has special protection, right? So it's a law, it's a bill that's making changes to sort of impose a congressional budget plan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, last year, there was a lot of talk about just moving all of health care, most of health care, as budget reconciliation legislation. Because a lot of it is changing the budget, right? Changing Medicare or, setting up a public health care plan.
Right, a public option, Medicaid, right? Yeah.
Public option, right? So that all is budgetary, and so you can move most health care reform that way. Well, the Democrats decided not to do that. So what's being talked about now is for the House to just vote on and pass the bill passed by the Senate last December. And that would be very easy in the sense that once the House endorses it, then it goes straight to the president can sign it. The problem with that strategy by itself is a lot of House Democrats are not crazy about the bill passed by the Senate.
Not only not crazy, but totally, hate it, as do I.
Right.
Yeah.
Because there's no public option, and because also the Senate bill would tax what's known as Cadillac health care plans. many of which are held by labor union members.
And you know what? Forget the labor unions. They cut their own deal, although that's thrown out because this happened after the Senate passed the bill. But for people like me, who my COBRA is running out next month, and I've got a pre-existing condition, and I'm 50 years old, and basically the only insurance I can get is going to cost around $1,000 a month with a $5,000 deductible. And because I've got a, you know, I can't even afford it as it is, and but because it's over $8,500 a year, that's considered a Cadillac plan, so I'd get taxed on it to boot. So, you know, it really hits the middle class right where it really hurts.
That's right. And so the House is not crazy about taxing these plans, and so one of the things they were hoping to fight for before the Massachusetts Senate election was to change that funding mechanism.
Right.
So if they just pass the Senate bill, one of their conditions is that the House and Senate pass a second bill that sort of that adopts all the things that the House wanted to change about the Senate bill, and that they were in the process of negotiating before the Massachusetts Senate election. And that second bill that makes these changes could pass as budget reconciliation legislation, so it only takes 51 votes in the Senate.
Okay, but I would think that the Congressional Progressive Caucus at least would have to have some assurances that that would actually happen before they would go ahead and vote.
That's right. So there's an issue of trust. The House Democrats, yeah, the Progressive Caucus, they wanted, you know, some ironclad guarantee that not only would the Senate, you know, talk about their bill, but actually, you know, pass it, and so it could become law.
Right, and you're saying trust and, you know, the U.S. Senate in the same breath, when we have people like Joe Lieberman and Ben Nelson and Mary Landrieu and Blanche Lincoln, that's a pretty tough, bitter pill to swallow.
That's right. So, and then like this, so there's news stories today, yesterday, we're talking about, oh, how some of these moderate Democratic senators are coming out saying, I don't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
I would be nervous if we tried to pass this budget reconciliation legislation. So you're right. I mean, so the House Democrats would be wise to be distrustful that the Senate would actually pass this follow-up bill. Which brings us back to square one, which
yes.
is what happens next. And,
right.
And I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. I think that's the problem.
Yeah, I guess we'll find out a lot, at least what the White House strategy is tonight at the State of the Union address.
Yeah.
Right? So you don't think they're going to make any move on the filibuster? You think they're just going to deal with these rules as they are and try to get some things done? With the party of no standing in the way at every turn.
That's exactly correct. I mean, there are a few senators who are beginning to introduce reform proposals, but the news coverage I've seen suggests that the Democratic Party leadership is not seriously interested in pursuing any of these ideas, at least not until after the 2010 elections.
I got you. All right. Well, Gregory Koger, professor of American politics at the University of Miami, his book will be out in June entitled Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate. Thank you so much for shedding some light on the situation for us, and I hope we can call on you again.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, there you go. That's Gregory Koger, and now it is time to get to the State of the Union.